Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Rabido, it's getting cold up north. I think it's time to maybe look to a slightly warmer climb.
Whatever. We'll just rug it up. We have a brand new furnace to keep us warm. Cashing in on that rebate for energy saving appliances and all that kind of good stuff. Because we're already thinking ahead to April 15th. The dread day, or is it March? No, it's April 15th. I always worry about what day it's going to be.
March 15th is the Ides of March. Because
we must be in another year. So before we say anything else, we must say welcome to the year 2010.
And happy 2010. Let's hope this decade is a lot better than the last one.
Yeah, pretty soon the 7th anniversary of the broadcast of On the Menu Radio. If it's hard to believe it's been that long. And we've got a nice theme for today's program because Anne was thinking about warmer climes. And guess what? This program's all about the great southern United States.
Matt Lee and Ted Lee, I'm so glad to be talking to you. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
You're on a whirlwind tour, as I gather, from your new cookbook. It's called The Lee Brothers, Simple, Fresh, Southern, Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. And boy, aren't they, huh?
Thank you. Yes.
I've already told you how in love I am with this book. I loved your other book, the classic Southern Cooking, but this is so much more modern and so much more personalized.
Well, we thought that it would be, based on the success with the first book, which, by the way, had, I guess, 225 recipes, 600 plus pages, it weighed 5 pounds.
Yeah.
It covered every aspect of Southern cooking, including some contemporary and quick takes and clever tricks and things like that. And it was those quick knockouts that really responded with people when we took it on the road and did cooking classes. So we figured let's compile a whole book of quick knockouts.
So you got to field test how people were using the recipes. What a great idea.
When we go on tour, we don't do so for the conventional 3 weeks. We consider the entire year a tour, and we schedule the part we love is really the grassroots part where we get to linger in a place for a few days and do an event at a bookstore, of course, but also an event at some sort of cooking arena, some place that has a demonstration kitchen. And then we also try to involve a restaurant in some fashion and maybe do a special night with a few dishes from the cookbook on the menu. And then as a kicker, we do a nightcap somewhere at maybe a different restaurant or a bar where we put a couple of the drinks from the cookbook on the menu, trying to just take a place by storm and really get people whipped up and excited about the book. And the
well, you're big-time celebrities. I mean, when we see you at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, we're all over you.
Well, that's our home turf. I would caution using the word celebrity around us, but maybe in Charleston we are.
Now, which one of this is talking?
This is Matt talking.
This is Matt. Okay, now let's switch over to Ted. Now, where are you today, Ted?
Today, we are talking to you from the McGraw-Hill Building in Midtown Manhattan, and that is because we came here to do a few media events, very cold and very far removed from the South.
Are you making TV appearances, too?
Well, we have done TV appearances in New York before. We were on the Today Show the day the book launched, which was great.
Yeah.
And we're going to be on Martha Stewart in January. But today we're just doing radio, and we're having a little bit of a launch party here in New York.
Oh boy, I wish you were there.
I wish you were too.
Where will you be doing the party?
We're doing it at a place called The Inn at Irving Place.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And it's a beautiful place with rooms that remind us of the South.
Uh-huh.
We felt it was really important to have a sense of southernness, since we're in New York, after all.
You live in New York as well, don't you?
Yes. Well, we're based in Charleston, but we go back and forth. In the last 2 years, actually, we've both gotten married, and we both married gals who are based in New York. So
oh,
we
really?
Go back and forth quite frequently, which is great because it certainly gives us a perspective on how special the foods of the South are, because they're in general although you can get some Southern food in New York, just that spirit of home cooking definitely gives us perspective.
Well, isn't that how you got started? You were languishing without peanuts.
Boiled peanuts.
That's right. This is Matt talking.
Matt's voice is deeper.
Shortly after college, we found ourselves in New York struggling to find a foothold anywhere, and we're outraged that we couldn't get boiled peanuts.
So that's how you all got started. So that's in the previous interview. Now, you remember Tony the Peanut Man in Charleston?
Of course.
Now he wasn't at the festival this year.
He wasn't.
No. At least we didn't see him. If he was, we got him recorded on the air. We got him to sing his famous song on the air. He's just an incredible young man.
Yeah, lovely guy.
I can't call him a young man. I guess he's a fairly old man.
His hallmark is his straw boater hat that's actually made from sweetgrass in the manner of the sweetgrass baskets.
I don't know if you know about his background, but he was in the aviation industry.
I didn't know that.
He helped build airplanes in Charleston, and he lost his job, and he couldn't find another job, and he was in a totally miserable frame of mind. And then somebody said, "Hey, Tony, if you can't find a job, at least do something. Why don't you boil peanuts?"
That's right. Well,
that was how he got started. It's really kind of an amazing story. And so I hope he's there. I hope he's there again this year. Well, now let's
talk about this cookbook.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that what an interesting way to do that might be to say, well, you selected some dishes to cook while you're in New York. Perhaps you'd like to start with that particular menu and why you chose it.
Sure, the party menu.
Yes.
The party menu. There you go.
The party begins with celery juleps.
Oh.
Which we make with a simple syrup that's been flavored with celery, and we fortify that a little bit with celery seeds that have been toasted. That boosts the celery flavor in the syrup.
You know, celery's staging some kind of a rush on a comeback. I don't know why, but...
Well, and this idea of combining bourbon and celery was not our own, but we encountered it in a cocktail served at a restaurant in New York that was mixing celery soda with bourbon. And
I think we had that celery soda. I think we had the people who make it on the program.
No, you're talking about the...
Well, it's hard to come by down south, and so we thought the next best thing would be to make a celery-flavored syrup. You know, we make a mint-flavored syrup to create our mint juleps, and so it was...
So you also
step.
Have products, Matt. Do you have products you sell to?
We do through the catalog, but that's a totally separate thing. The cookbook empowers people to do it themselves. So.
Well, I'm looking at the celery julep as we speak.
Yeah.
Nice photos.
So then for nibbles, we have spiced Georgia pecans from the first cookbook. The recipe is in there. We have cheese straws from the first cookbook. We have jade shrimp cocktail from the new cookbook, Simple
yeah, that's
Fresh
here.
Southern. And the idea there is a cocktail sauce that's green rather than red and has a familiar hit of horseradish, but it's really about green tomatoes or tomatillos.
Yeah, you have tomatillos. It sounds
wonderful.
Wonderfully creamy and rich avocado is blended into that. It's just a wonderful dip for shrimp, but also for crudité if you prefer, or tortilla chips. It's a fantastic green dip, and it's just happens to be sort of tart and luscious and.
But you have honey in it. That's odd, isn't
got
it?
Got a hint of honey, yeah.
Huh.
And, well, I mean, ketchup has tons of corn syrup and still registers as a savory product. This has a lot less sweetener than ketchup.
And no high fructose corn syrup, thank the Lord.
No, absolutely.
None of that.
So then we've got, from the new cookbook, Grand's Marinated Flank Steak, which is so simple. It's just the marinade is three equal parts, water, soy sauce, and bourbon.
Oh, wow, that sounds great.
And briefly marinated, briefly seared, or broiled, if you prefer that, and then sliced very thin and accordion folded onto a skewer with a drizzle of the reserved and concentrated marinade that's also got just a hint of brown sugar in there.
So you made it into finger food.
That's right.
Yes.
You have to, as you know, with cocktail parties, you have to transform foods into something a little more convenient.
Right.
Then we have country ham, a righteous country ham, totally as it is, sliced paper thin from Alan Benton.
Oh, the famous Alan Benton, huh?
Yes, his ham is very useful for serving at a cocktail party because it's so vibrantly smoked. It has such a smoky flavor that the smoke does come through when you slice it paper thin and serve it on a toothpick. And we're pairing it with half a pickled grape from the new cookbook.
Oh, that I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah,
I never heard of that.
Well, we hadn't either, but we thought it sounded like a good idea for livening up those Thompson seedless grapes that are in the markets year-round.
You just made that up, huh?
We did. I can't believe that it hasn't been done before, because it's just grapes pickled in a, you know, sort of half and half brine vinegar, seasoned with rosemary and garlic, two Mediterranean
and chilies.
Herbs and chilies, right.
Now, could you use scuppernongs to do that too?
You could, although
they wouldn't
be edible in one bite.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Skins tend to be thicker and barely edible, and the seeds.
Now, we discovered scuppernongs in, of all places, the Whole Foods Market in Greenville on our way to visit our son and daughter-in-law, and we couldn't even figure out what the name was. You know, we tried to remember. We saw it there, and we said, "What scuppernogs or scumbuggers or whatever it is?" We couldn't figure out what they were, and then we discovered that they got the name from the Scuppernong River in North Carolina.
That's right.
Right, and they're just one of a variety of
muscadine grapes.
Muscadines are the native grapes of the Southeast, and they're delicious eaten out of hand. And we love them in preparations like pies. We make preserves out of them. But they're also great in a savory setting. And one of the special things we've seen done with them is just a chef in Athens, Georgia, Hugh Atchison at the 5 and 10 restaurant. He roasts scuppernong grapes as a side dish for veal.
Oh, wow, that sounds great. Anyway, back to the party menu, because we didn't even get...
Oh, right.
We didn't get beyond the appetizers. It sounds like a hell of a party.
Well, I mean, it's all finger food.
It's all a cocktail party.
But okay. We have other items yet, and one is shots of she-crab soup.
Oh, wow.
A crab soup that's cream-based, dosed with a very good bottle of Madeira, I would add. And then... garnished with a little bit of roe. It's actually not crab roe. Back in the day, you'd garnish it with orange crab roe, but it resembles in flavor and color tobiko roe, that sushi roe.
Japanese
stuff. That's what we've been garnishing it with these days, but it'll have really nice lump crab meat in that shot as well.
And that sounds absolutely fabulous. Now, let's suppose that you were, instead of doing a cocktail reception only, you were doing a sit-down dinner and you were choosing from the book. Probably might do some of the same appetizers, but what would be some of the mains and desserts that you would follow with?
Well, I think that one of the ones that I'm loving right now is the pork tenderloin with Madeira and fig gravy. And that's just a fabulous and really easy dish to entertain with, because pork tenderloins really don't take that long to cook.
As long as you have guests that eat pork.
Yeah, we were reading an article the other day in the local paper about what to do in terms of cooking when you're not sure whether people will like what's on the menu.
Right.
Well, not only that, I wrote the holiday. I got the chefs to contribute to the article on holiday. A holiday meal, and the centerpiece was roast pork. So I scrambled when I suddenly realized that this was not PC.
Yeah.
So I said, but you could use the same flavorings with turkey.
Right. Well, we have plenty of dishes that are in the cookbook that are not pork. And one of the things I think is one of the easiest recipes, and the one that could also be used for a crowd, is the crispy skin salmon with buttermilk mint sauce.
Oh,
that's
boy.
A really easy one that you just crisp a whole, a side of salmon in the broiler so that the skin gets crispy and delicious. And then you serve it with a simple buttermilk mint sauce. And it's just so easy to make. It's just buttermilk, sour cream, mint, and olive oil.
Just by way of explanation, you would cook that first with the fish side up and then finish with the skin side up?
No, we only do it with the skin side down, so that the skin side is facing the broiler.
I'm thinking about our oven broiler where the heat source is on the top.
So it's skin side up for the entire length of the cooking, which is only about 5 minutes.
Great. It's really funny that you should mention that, because this must be probably not terribly traditionally Southern. I know we discovered crispy skin salmon for the first time at a Japanese restaurant in Melbourne, Australia, about 9 or 10 years ago. We're not even sure the restaurant is still there.
Right.
So it's a very Japanese way of doing salmon.
Sure.
But you've added it to the Southern lexicon of food, I guess.
Yeah, well, we grew up eating a lot of salmon. Our parents cooked a lot of salmon And I just think it's not necessarily Southern, but it certainly is in our diet. You see salmon cakes a lot in Southern cookbooks. And so we just sort of added, you're right, that we got our interest in the crispy skin part of it from a Japanese restaurant in Charleston, actually.
There you go. So is the same source.
It upset us. I remember as a child, when our mom cooked salmon, she would leave the skin on, but it was poached.
Yes,
and it was this gooey, gummy thing.
Slimy is the word that comes to mind.
Exactly, slimy. And so now we've taken it and we've made it a crispy, delicious thing that, you know, it's like the best potato chip you've ever had.
Now, do you put oil on this, on that surface?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We do.
Just a little sort
of...
Just a little
oil and salt and pepper.
Okay. Now, do you wipe it on or do you spray it on?
I wipe it on with my hand.
Okay.
Yeah, the general theme of this book is... It's rooted in your Southern sensibility, but it's modernized. You use ingredients in different ways. You're not afraid to step outside of your Southern culture to get ingredients and seasonings and flavorings. Do I get that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the kind of trick we love to perform is like that trick of broiling scuppernong grapes with salt and pepper. And
I love that idea.
Thinking of them as in some other fashion. We normally think of them, Southerners normally think of scuppernong grapes, the native grapes, as dessert. And this chef in Athens, Georgia thought, hey, why not broil them, treat them as a savory product, and serve them alongside a veal chop? You know, that's an idea that he probably got from a dish that he encountered in Italy or something like that. It's okay to borrow, you know, new ideas and to see fit for Southern food to move forward and to change in slight ways, as long as it clings tightly to its roots and to the ingredients that we are blessed with in the South. And
we,
you know,
must pass judgment of all these other Southern cooks and writers, because they all have testimonials on the dust jacket. Martha Hall Foose likes it. Paula Deen likes it. John Edge likes it. Now, Katie Lee Joel, she's not Southern, is she?
She's from West Virginia.
Oh, well, that's not really Southern.
used to be Southern before 1861, I guess.
Yeah.
And Mario Batali certainly isn't Southern. But he likes you, too. Well, I'd like to do this cookbook, like starting at the beginning and cooking through, like Julie, what's her name, did with Mastering the Art of French Cooking with Julia Child. It's just... one thing after another, even the purlieu, which is a whole other treatise, I guess, the whole issue of purlieu.
Right.
That's Southern, but this one is different.
That's right. It's a vegetable purlieu with mushrooms and okra, and other vegetables too, but the title is Mushroom and Okra and Okra Purlieu. And a purlieu is simply cooking your rice with something flavorful in it, and conventionally that's a chicken or some sort of protein. And in our case, we wanted to do one that had all of the lusciousness of rice cooked up with a protein, but with vegetables. And so we selected for that the most robust, meaty vegetables we could think of. And, you know, portobello mushrooms are right up there with dark,
umami.
Rich, meaty.
Yeah.
And okra, too, is just a wonderful, it's more of a green flavor, but a wonderful complement to the mushrooms.
Here's a question for you guys. Do they still grow rice in South Carolina?
Ever much more so.
They're still doing a lot.
Yes, it's with the sort of interest in homegrown ingredients and artisanal products and native ingredients, there's been a movement to grow again this particular variety called Carolina Gold.
Yes.
That was very popular in the 19th century South. And the reason the South stopped making rice was they lost their cheap form of labor, but also that, and thank God they did.
Yeah, let's not go too far into that one.
Well, but also the advent of the pump, that in Louisiana and Texas and then California, pumping water rather than letting the tide the water away.
Okay,
much more efficient, and you could control better growing of the crop.
So you got a serious competition from other parts of the country.
Yeah, you could grow rice on dry land and then run a tractor through it and harvest it that way. In South Carolina, our marshes are made of the softest sort of chocolate pudding consistency mud, and so to grow it there, you can do it, but it takes a mighty fight against the elements to
do it.
Now, we just got back from Valencia, Spain, just a couple of months ago, and there's a tremendous rice culture there. And we had, of course, the famous paella at a property right in the middle of the rice fields. It's really remarkable. But they stopped growing rice for a period of time. There was some environmental reason why. And for like a couple of centuries, I think they didn't grow rice, and then they just revived that within recent memory.
Right. Well, the revival in South Carolina has been very, very, very small scale. It's mostly private landowners who have an acre or so of appropriate land, and it's more for novelty value and to serve a local farmer's market or a local chef, that kind of thing. But it can be found in very short supply.
Now, this is a wonderful book. It's called, again, Anne, what's the title, simply?
It's called Simple, Fresh, Southern. And I think that the subtitle here, Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor, pretty much sums it up.
And it's a little bit less of a brick.
Oh, yes. I mean, the other book makes my thighs go numb when I'm holding it. it won a James Beard Award, so I wish you luck with this one.
Well, thank you so much.
Now, you must have a website. You probably have a website as well, guys?
It's simplefreshsouthern.com, and our tour schedule, sample recipes, videos, posts from the road are all there at simplefreshsouthern.com.
Well, we're so glad we caught up with you. We hope you'll survive the cold weather in New York and retreat reasonably unfrozen to Charleston, and I hope that we'll catch up with you in person at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival in March 5, 2010. So that's,
same here.
That's upcoming, listeners, so mark that one in your calendar. It's a great event.
Yeah, and these are really inspired, like skillet green beans with orange. I mean, I could go on. I'm going to let you go, though. But I really, as I told you, love this cookbook, and it has great photographs, too.
Thank you. We look forward to cooking with you at some point.
Hey, that would be fun. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and
hopefully see you in March.
See you then.
See you in March.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please return our shout out and good wishes for 2010 and give us a shout out as well. I think that's what we call it.
Is that what we do?
We shout out.
It's called a shout out now. I never knew it was called a shout out. But anyway, one of the iconic properties in the southern United States.
I want to go there.
You want to,
very badly.
And wants to go to Blackberry Farm very badly. And
I like Sam Bell.
You like Sam Bell a lot. Sam Bell was a whole lot of fun. He has a whole heavy cookbook that he's produced as well, just as if more people didn't need to know about Blackberry Farm. But anyway, here he is in eastern Tennessee, Sam Bell from Blackberry Farm.
Sam Bell, where the Blackberry Farm is located, appears to be a little bit of paradise. Welcome to On the Menu. We're talking, of course, about the property, Blackberry Farm, and also your latest venture, Blackberry Farm Cookbook, Four Seasons of Great Food and the Good Life. So welcome.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
How about getting more specific about exactly where you're located?
Well, in the far east part of Tennessee, just outside the foothills, we are in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee.
And it's beautiful. I mean, there's so many landscape shots in this book. Isn't it extraordinarily beautiful as a place?
I think it's an absolutely unique part of this country. Of course, I'm a little jaded. I find it to be one of the most beautiful parts, but truly unique is something that would be undisputable.
Why don't you explain to our listeners what Blackberry Farm is?
Well, Blackberry Farm is a 9,200-acre luxury resort in the Smoky Mountains. We have 63 rooms, so we are an operating hotel, if you will. We are also a working farm. We have 6 acres of gardens that supply our restaurants with the majority of the produce that we use. We have 180 sheep that give us the milk for the sheep milk cheeses that we make in our dairy. The chickens roaming the property provide us with our chicken eggs. And so it is very much a a working farm, but also one that our guests can experience. And just like going to the spa or horseback riding or fly fishing are popular activities for our guests, spending a day or a morning with our master gardener to plant or to harvest, or spending a milking session with our cheesemaker to actually milk the sheep and begin to make the cheese. These are now activities that are becoming just as popular as perhaps those more common activities.
Now, this is the Mr. Kuykendall that you write about in the book, who has saved 175 varieties of regional beans.
Exactly. John is kind of our eternal figure in the garden, but also Jeff Ross, an incredible talent that actually manages the day-to-day operations. They represent our garden team.
Now, have you been to the Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons in England, where they have a huge garden too?
I have not.
Oh, it's an experience you should offer yourself.
Well, you might pick up a couple of ideas. One I'll share with you that I thought was particularly intriguing. The last time we were there, Chef Raymond Blanc, who was the owner, had asked the gardener to experiment with creating a wild mushroom environment.
Oh, that was fun, yeah.
So he had a little stream and decaying logs. And didn't have to worry about the rainfall, and you probably get plenty of that too. So he created an environment in which he was going to try to grow his own wild mushroom.
Well, we're not England, but we do have our own little mushroom operation as well.
There we go. So you already have one.
Well, we do. We cultivate a variety of mushrooms, predominantly shiitake, but our area is so abundant with wild mushrooms that we don't need to cultivate any more, because
right.
We can hardly harvest. I swear we probably harvested 600 pounds of chanterelles this year. It's just the bounty in this area.
Oh, so you do a lot of foraging. Yeah.
A lot of foraging, yes.
Now, the history of the property is interesting. Since your parents bought it, I guess Dad was in the food business?
He was and still is. That's
Is he still with Ruby Tuesday?
He is.
And Mom likes to decorate?
Mom, she might claim she doesn't like it, but she's the best at it.
There you go. So this is, but the idea of a working farm is still a work in process. It wasn't a working farm when you acquired it.
Very true. I mean, it had some history as a farm, but it most definitely was not a working farm, and nor did it truly become a part of our guest experience. Even until about 10 years ago.
But you've got a perspective on the region because you also live there, right? You and your family live on the property?
We do live right here on the property, right in the middle of it. But I was born here. I was born in the main house where our guests sleep today.
See, I forget because I was born in the 1940s. I forget that people were born more recently than that.
Yeah, you have three different chefs, right?
We do, because we have two different restaurants and...
Tell us something about the restaurants.
Sure. Well, first of all, two different venues, two physically different locations. One is the main house that our guests have come to know over the past 20 years. And in the main house, Joseph Lynn is our chef in the evenings. He's a Tennessee boy. If he's not cooking in the kitchens, he's fishing in our creeks. And his cuisine reflects the South in every way. I mean, deeply Southern. Also in the main house, during the day, breakfast and lunch, we have a dedicated chef that has his own identity for breakfast and lunch, because many people define Blackberry culinary experience by a great breakfast and lunch as well. So his name is Josh Feathers, and he's, I think, the best breakfast-lunch cook in the country. And then 2 years ago, we opened up a new restaurant. It's a barn. It's a barn that we've recovered and restored. Dates back to 1802.
It's beautiful. You have a photograph in the book.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do.
This is the one that's called Yellowhammers, or?
No.
Oh, that's a different thing. That's another thing altogether.
The Yellowhammer is just an outdoor venue, which occasionally we use for special events, for special dinners. But the barn is today our fine dining venue. It's the antique linens and the sterling silver and the custom china, but it's set within, 60-foot exposed beams or 60-foot ceilings and exposed beams. And this barn is a 17,000 square foot barn. But we're only using a portion of it for the dining room. The rest of it is a wine cellar and a demonstration kitchen. We do food and wine events throughout the year, but demonstration kitchen, bakery, and a chocolate room, and et cetera. But Adam
chocolate
Cook,
room?
Yes. Adam Cook is our chef of the barn, and the cuisine of the barn is a little bit more composed, a little, more of the multi-course tasting menu experience, fine dining, as I said earlier, the main house being somewhat more relaxed.
Well, and so overall your food is Southern, but personalized by the talents of your chefs?
Correct. I think that's fair to say.
How difficult is it getting reservations there?
During certain times of the year, it can be difficult.
I mean, I'm thinking of in at Little Washington, and you have to be months and months in advance, some
right.
Years, actually.
Well, in Little Washington is an incredible property, and Patrick O'Connell is an incredible person. But as I was saying, it just depends. During certain times of the year, you might have to book months or even some cases a year out. We have a lot of the same repeat guests. 80% of all of our guests are repeat guests, as crazy as that might sound. So sometimes they just come back year after year, and it makes it difficult for others to squeeze in. But in general, you shouldn't have too much trouble getting a reservation here.
You make your own charcuterie too, I see that. You do everything yourself pretty much.
Well, I won't say everything. I don't feel the need to do everything. Honestly, I'm not sure we would offer our guests the best experience if we had that mentality of being totally self-sustaining. And because we've got neighbors that do great things, and we have other people in this region which do special things, and we have great chefs that come in to Blackberry for our food and wine events from around the world that might expose us to new practice or a new ingredient, and why not share that with our guests as well, in the right application. So, yes, we do a lot of what we do is right here on the farm.
I like your sheep. What kind are they?
Most of them are East Frisian sheep. They're a great breed for the milking purpose that
they're
we have.
They're good mothers, aren't they?
They are.
And they're originally from the Netherlands, like the Frisian cows?
Well, I think their origins might go back a little bit more eastern. And we also have a variety of sheep, caracoles, caracol breed.
That means snail in Spanish.
Well, go figure that one out if you can. Figure that one out. Now, part of the reason, of course, that we wanted you to join the program was to talk about this absolutely glorious book that landed like a brick on our doorstep just a couple of months ago, on absolutely the heaviest paper, a challenge to stand up straight on any bookshelf because it's very large. It focuses more on the kind of cooking that you do or the kind of cooking that happens in the kitchens that you just described?
Well, both. Okay. I think you'll get an opportunity to have a menu, a recipe that is more driven for the home cook, but also some that are more intricate that are found in our restaurant. So a little bit of both.
And organized by season?
Very much so. I mean, that's the way we live. That's the way our menus are created, and it's the way things should be.
So would you like to go through and take maybe a sample menu from each season, talk us through one of your favorites, and then just let our listeners whet their appetite by hearing what it might be like if they had this book and they tried to cook from it, or if they just chickened out and decided they'd just fly to Knoxville and stay with you because it's easier?
Well, that's always the better way to go. You can't really experience Blackberry. You can't fully understand Blackberry unless you've paid a visit to us. So I'd highly encourage that. But sure, I can try to do that. I don't have a book in front of me, so it's kind of off the top of my head. But so
I'm sure you'll do it, Sam.
Okay.
I have a feeling these menus are imprinted in your mind.
They are. I think that's fair to say. You know what? In summer, which I think is where our book starts off, how can you avoid mentioning barbecue? Because barbecue is perhaps a little bit more reflective of Western Tennessee, but Tennessee as a whole, and we've done a baked bean recipe here, which I think showcases the simplicity of beans, but also using, I think, some classic ingredients or very iconic ingredients of this place. A ham hock. Alan Benton of Benton's Country Ham is located.
I mean, that's,
just,
yeah. I mean,
I'm surprised he can keep up with the demand. Everybody uses his name so much.
Well, he's our neighbor. I mean, a lot of people use
him. Oh, he's right next door. Okay.
I mean, he lives 20 miles from us.
Oh,
and I mean, we've used his product since.
Oh, well, he's the best on the market. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Anyway, I won't claim how he was introduced to a lot of our friends, but anyway, his ham hock or a great ham hock will very much define a great pot of baked beans. But also the sweetness. I think in the recipe we did here, more of the honey and the mustard component, but also sorghum is something that we use in our baked beans for that level of sweetness. That now at home, I will cook these baked beans in a cast iron pot out on the grill, out on the,
yeah,
the smoker,
smoking,
to kind of,
yeah,
impregnate the beans with some of that natural wood smoke that you get in the barbecue, but often not in the beans. And
now, we should probably mention that this book contains wonderful photographs of your family and life on the property. And then also, secondly, that you're not just a pretend chef. I mean, you have worked in some of the finest restaurants in the country and went to culinary school. So you know what you're talking about.
Well, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about, but yes, it is my background. I've grown up in the restaurant business almost my whole life, working in kitchens, and did go to culinary school and have worked at restaurants such as the French Laundry. And
yeah, that little minor note. He worked at the French Laundry, right?
Now, what about
Thomas is a fan of Blackberry Farm.
So we've had baked beans and Alan Benton's ham hocks for summer. Now what about fall?
Okay, so switching to fall. Let's see, in the fall, we're really starting to think about lamb. The lamb that we use to milk on the property, we also harvest, and I guess that comes to mind first.
So that's where the Yalimers comes in, because that's where you cook it, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, actually we do an event down there each year, and down at the Yalimer we have these outdoor wood-burning ovens, and we really love to use fire. I mean, natural fire. Yes, in one of our restaurants we have gas grill, but as soon as I can rip that baby out, it's coming. In our other restaurant, it's wood-burning oven, wood-burning grill. And as you mentioned, this outdoor venue, the Yellowhammer Pavilion, I think that's what kind of defines, you know, a certain culinary experience is when you really get to have the gristle. And I'm not even saying smoke. Using wood doesn't necessarily define a product that's going to be smoked. But the subtle character of wood-burning coals versus what the heat of an oven can result in can be just that bright line of definition of what you might find in a great urban restaurant and a more rural culinary experience, perhaps. But that's the first thing that came to mind, again, just because we have stopped milking and we're harvesting some of our animals. And when we do, we have an incredible butchery program. And when we harvest an animal here, we respect that animal, and nothing gets wasted. Everything is utilized. And that takes us into, you know, some of our charcuterie and preserved meat efforts.
It looks good. I mean, it looks like you've got a great program there.
Okay, now wintertime.
Well, what about black walnuts? I love this section on black walnuts. That was the bane of my childhood.
Oh, well, I love to hear somebody that's aware of black walnuts, because black walnuts are so distinct. I mean, I think there are few people in the world who've actually experienced black walnut. It is so different.
I love your discussion of how you open them, because that was always the hard part, you know, how you open those things. And you suggested that you can put them down on the road and drive over them.
Well, I wouldn't recommend that. It'll mention a little bit more in humor, but indeed they are hard, but they're worth it.
Black walnut soup. No, I used this because I wanted to point out one aspect of the book is that there are some unexpected recipes in here. It's not same old, same old. It's not just Southern, like most of the books on Southern cuisine. And you had kimchi. Kale, was it? Collards.
Kimchi collards, actually. But it can be done with kale just as well. And it's a great zip, added zip to, you know, really any dish. Something we love.
So, but I'm just saying that I think that people who buy the book will find some amazing, amazing recipes in it, and things off the beaten path, and also people who come to Blackberry Farm will have that experience as well, right?
Right, absolutely.
That and the fact that you have so many interesting people working there, like the Truffle Man of East Tennessee and characters that you meet on the way.
Well, it's something that it's unavoidable. If you come to Blackberry, you're going to experience the artisans, and that's really what makes this place tick. Blackberry is not about any one person, any one owner, any one chef, any one gardener. It's this team of artisans that makes this place tick. And you throw in the forger, and you throw in the cheesemaker, and the our butcher, and our baker, and our chocolatier, and the chefs on top of that. It's an experience that I think is rare to find under one roof. They're all here, and they're all working together for this bigger cause. So it's a huge part of who we are.
And Peter wants a winter recipe, right?
Well, I was going to round out the calendar pretty quickly.
Okay, well, to round out this effort,
parsnips.
I haven't mentioned pork, and that's almost a sin for me, a Southerner, not to have mentioned pork to this point. But pork belly. Pork belly is such a simple and low-cost cut of meat that we're all familiar with. It's bacon. But to experience it on a fresh side, it's something that's so savory, so satisfying, and when done right, it's just overindulging, and I think a great showcase of the type of cuisine that can be found at Blackberry. But so we do to make it more Southern, a bourbon braised pork belly on grits with caramelized onions, and it's just a true taste of the South.
Oh, Peter's drooling right now.
I wish I was going to have some for dinner. And interestingly enough, we just had we interviewed another chef who's probably going to be in this very program from the Hot and Hot Fish Club in Birmingham, Alabama.
Sure, and, Chris Hastings. He's a great person.
Yeah, and Chris starts his book in spring. End your book in spring. So what about to end the interview? Exciting spring recipe as the year wakes up.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. Well, in spring we're starting to think about tomatoes, but we haven't quite got there yet.
You do heirlooms, though, don't you?
Oh, we do, and we start a lot in our greenhouse. But the green tomatoes are coming online, so we haven't gotten to the point to showcase, you know, the beauty of the perfect sweet July August tomato. But we do a green tomato skillet cake, which is a lot of fun.
Wow, that sounds great.
Sounds wonderful, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, on this menu, we serve it with a smoked veal breast. Veal breast can, because it's got that beautiful bone to work with, it's something that just breaks down into pull off the bone with your fork, barbecue tender, melt in your mouth, butter, veal breast, and it's a great complement to the little higher acid bite of those green tomatoes to complement the nice savory quality of the veal breast.
And we should mention that this property is a member of Relais and Chateau, which tells you it's a very solid quality property. Also, it probably is fairly expensive, no?
Well, perhaps at first glance, we operate with kind of an all-American plan. Everything's inclusive because we don't want you carrying a wallet around. We don't want you to be tipping,
that's good to
you know, our team, and they don't expect it. They don't want it. So all of that's built in, and you know, it's like you're at our home because it is our home. And if you come over to my house, you don't need a wallet.
Right.
So
I like that.
Right. So anyway, people can make reservations through your website. I'm sure.
Correct.
Go ahead and record it for us.
One can make reservations through our website, but honestly, we love the phone. We love to speak with our guests because if it's a new guest, we need to get to know you to ensure that we can exceed all your expectations.
Okay, so go ahead. Give a phone number. Do you have an email address as well? You don't like email either.
No.
No, I mean,
we very much like email. The email address at Blackberry Farm is simply www.blackberryfarm.com. And our phone number is 865-984-8166.
Okay, and the book is actually on our website. You can, it's called the Blackberry Farm Cookbook. You can order that. Now, I want to say, Sam, you've got great hair. Is that red?
I'm sorry?
Your hair, is it red?
I wish. I've always wanted red hair.
Yeah, I've always wanted red hair, too.
Or I've always wanted a kid that had red hair, but no, I don't think it's gray or red.
Oh, see, it looks to me like you have really beautiful red curly hair in this photo in the book jacket. Anyhow, sorry to throw a curve question at you, but I was just curious because I've always wanted red hair myself.
Well, listen, Ann and Peter are going to be headed your way one of these days, you can be sure, Sam, and we really enjoyed talking to you today. And I have a last piece of advice for those of you who would like to get in shape for heading to Blackberry Farms. Do sit-ups with the cookbook in your arms. and you'll be ready to do justice to the wonderful dishes that Sam talked about and all the other ones on the menu as well. Sam, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Sam,
well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Now it's time to take a break. Well, here we are again, and moving right along, here's someplace else I want to go to. It's called the Hot and Hot Fish Club
And their new cookbook is very enticing as well.
In Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
And
if you find the name of the place odd, we can hear the story.
You'll find out why, and your path will soon head to Birmingham, Alabama, just like we intend to do.
Now, we've known about the Hot and Hot Fish Club for quite a long time because I get regular newsletters from them, but I didn't quite grasp it until this gorgeous cookbook landed on my doorstep here. And we're going to be talking to co-owner and chef Chris Hastings, who with his wife, Heidi, owns this establishment in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome, Chris. It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you, Anne. I really appreciate it. You're kind to have us on.
Well, now, you are a Southerner by ancestry, even.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's tied in to the name of your restaurant and the name of the cookbook. Why don't you just start by telling us about the Hot and Hot Fish?
Well, it's a very interesting name, and it has a very long tradition, an old tradition, actually. As a young person, I grew up spending my summers on Polly's Island, and all, you know, Southerners, we sit around the table and we talk about our families and our history, and we get to know whom we are, and conversation always wound back to the Hot and Hot Fish Club and the men who owned the plantations at the time, and how they gathered together to eat. And how important that was. And, you know, that tradition lives on in my family today. But in those days, what would happen is if you were a landowner and you socially you would gather in men's clubs. And you, whether you was an equestrian club, if you were a horseman, or if you were a military person, you'd gather in a military club. Or most men were members of agricultural clubs because rice was the agricultural engine and the economic engine of the region. So, but the clubs were their social outlets. And the Hot and Hot Fish Club referred to what they did. They gathered at their clubhouse between May and October of every year to go out in the salt marsh and fish and gather oysters and shrimp and fish, and they'd bring it back to the clubhouse and they'd have these huge legendary meals. Part of the colloquialism of the time, too, was if you just were putting something on the table that was piping hot, steaming hot, just out of the oven, it was referred to as hot and hot.
That's
where you get the term hot and hot. Now, fish club obviously refers to the clubhouse where they serve copious amounts of fish. And so also one of the things that came of these conversations when I was a child is I became fascinated with my family history and said, well, I should go ahead and join the South Carolina Historical Society and dig some information up about who I am and where, whence I came, and some of the ancestry. And so as I dug through all of these old manuals about 80 years ago, who was living in that part of the world, and found out about Hugh Fraser, and he came from Edinburgh, Scotland, and was my earliest ancestor. He came over in 1790, and they formed officially the club in 1840, and these men also were writers and storytellers, so you would get these excerpts from these tales in there about the value and the importance of what they did at the club. They really, really loved this idea of going to their clubhouse, shedding all of their worries and any pretense of the day, and escaping to the clubhouse where they would go out into nature, enjoy the magnificence of the catching and the gathering, and then they would have these meals that to them, you know, the opportunity to sit down, break bread with people that they cared about, and enjoy some downtime was pivotal to them. It was very important to the quality of their life, and I thought, well, you know, wow, that's really a powerful message. If we, 180 years later, can provide a respite, greatest hope of beauty is to give people a chance to escape, and that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to find people an escape, a place where they could come, gather with their close friends, break bread, enjoy a great meal, and really let the door close behind them and let their worries fade away for a couple of hours while they enjoyed a great meal. Really resonated with us.
Now, do you have the same rules? The Hot and Hot Fish Club had a whole lot of rules which are printed inside the cover of the book. Now, presumably you have relaxed those rules somewhat in your restaurant?
Well, we like the rules about champagne particularly, but those seem to be very civilized. We thought, wow, that's a very civilized rules. But No, we do not. All comers are invited, and we just want to provide that place where people can enjoy a meal and relax and enjoy life.
Now, you settled in Birmingham some time ago.
That's correct.
Because your culinary career, perhaps it didn't start there, but certainly you spent many years there with good OTM buddy Frank Stitt.
Yep.
And he must have been a great influence on the way you approach the task of cooking.
There's no question that when I came to work for Frank that I had just come from the Ritz-Carlton in Buckhead, where I'd worked with a bunch of European chefs over Europe, very talented, skilled people, but a very different perspective.
Very different. Yeah, different breed altogether, yeah.
Totally. But you know, the technical skills learned there and the old world skills that they had brought with them while cooking in a very contemporary way, tremendous lesson, tremendous opportunity to learn classic European technique, cooking, thought process, how Europeans approach cooking, and then take that, leave that environment, go to work for Frank. Frank has a very obviously Southern but yet, you know, French approach to the way he thinks and cooks, and so I learned a lot from Frank.
And it's also very ingredient-focused, local and seasonal.
Right.
And, I mean, you were doing that before. I mean, now everybody seems to want to do that, of course, but you've done that for years.
20 years. We did seasonal cuisine before seasonal cuisine was cool.
Yes, I was about to say that. Now, your book is organized along those lines, too. Mm-hmm. You organize it on 2-month periods, right?
Right. That's the way we live our life. The book starts out with us living in San Francisco, and if what we did both at the Ritz-Carlton and then ultimately with Frank was kind of approaching seasonal, you move to California and you see what goes on there, that is where American seasonal regional cuisine was born. And so it took that whole notion to the next level. And so going to the farmer's market was totally different in California than it was in Birmingham. You had cheesemakers, fishermen, oystermen, produce people, you name it, it was there. And there were this network of relationships of disproportionately passionate people gathering at these markets where chefs were and the general public came, and you could actually live a life seasonally every day as a human being, as a person, not just as a restaurateur. And man, that was powerful. Really powerful. That took the whole idea to a completely different level working with Bradley Ogden. And because at that time, talking about 1980s, the local Birmingham area had not develop that extensive relationship with apiaries and cheesemakers and organic farmers. Now that exists, but in 1985 through 89, that was not the case. We were just starting to crack the code there.
Yeah, but in San Francisco and those areas, it certainly was the case then.
Well, it had been established for 20 years by people like Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and Mark
Peel. You're talking about Mark Peel?
Not Mark Peel, Mark Miller.
Mark Miller. Okay.
Mark Miller worked with Jeremiah Tower at Chez Panisse 100 years ago.
Now, you know what we haven't mentioned? I think you ought to mention. Your wife is also she went to culinary school. She's a pastry chef.
Very skilled pastry chef,
and she's your partner. Shares this passion with you.
There you go. She's the boss. Unlike the spouses of the members of the Hot and Hot Fish Club.
Correct. We've been well trained over the last 180 years to reverse that trend.
There we go. Well, why don't we venture into the book itself?
Could we talk about the introduction says that this is intended, this book, as a manual on living well.
Correct.
And it talks about, and you have interspersed lifestyle menus, family history, the influences of your mother, Angelica. So the whole book has a very warm personal tone to it. It's the furthest from these antiseptic manuals that I could ever find.
Charles Gaines, who wrote the foreword, is a dear friend, and we've spent many, many meals together in all kinds of places all over the world, and he's a liver of life himself, and he understands the value and the importance of that. He knows whom Heidi and I are, and he understood, when I asked him to write the foreword, he knew what we were after, what we wanted to convey, which is a life lived, not just in a restaurant, not just through these boring kind of tomes of recipe, you know, bore me to tears stuff. I mean, that's not the way we live our life. Our life truly is lived seasonally. I mean, we go through...
You have your wife and you have two sons here, what, teenagers?
Yes, 16 and 18.
16 and 18. And you also profile your producers, which is fabulous.
Those are the real heroes. Don't let anybody fool you.
Oh, I know.
Too many people want to fall in praise on chefs, and quite frankly, it gets gratuitous and old and kind of silly when the truth is, the inside baseball on this is that the real heroes of food are those people because they have devoted their lives, their disproportionate passion to growing that thing which they love so dearly, which only gives us a hope. Their work is what gives us a hope at greatness, a shot at it. If we can ply our trade and do a good job with their products, there's a chance. But if it were not for those people, we'd be stuck with mediocre products that you can never do great things with.
Well, what do you mean by magical cooking or memory cuisine?
Okay. I have been in more places than I can count where people tired and worn out and just at the end of their rope and at the end of their day exhausted, and they sit down in a place, whether it's a meal together, and I'll give you an example about one of those meals, where they all of a sudden they start tasting food and they having conversation and they have a sip of wine and a taste of food and their whole body language changes. They feel that the food takes them somewhere. It may have been a childhood memory of a flavor, whether that's a taste of a honeysuckle that if you've ever as an adult tasted a honeysuckle and then you're magically transformed instantly to that bush where you first tasted a honeysuckle or your first oyster or that great taste of wine, whatever it happened to be. Food has a way to take you places, both from a sensory and a memory standpoint, that is completely magical. I had a meal that I was preparing at Robert and Margaret Mondavi's house, probably 8 or 10 years ago. And we were there with a small group of people. We had been invited into their home, and I was the chef for an evening. And Mr. Mondavi hadn't been feeling well. He'd had back surgery. He was just kind of grumpy and grouchy and really not into it. And Margaret and I had worked out some menu things that kind of turned, you know, some of the logical progressions on wine and food a little bit upside down, and just wanted to have fun with food and enjoy just a great evening together. And it kind of irritated Mr. Mondavi when he sat down. He said, you know what? You know, he wasn't in a good mood in the first place, and he just really didn't want to be there because he was in pain, and it just was not his moment. But as the evening progressed, and he understood what Margaret and I had tried to achieve, and he began to taste the food, and he began to taste his own wine, and he began to kind of forget about his pain for a moment. In this moment, again, I said earlier, the greatest hope of beauty is it is a respite, is it an escape. And food kind of has that potential to be that, and it happened magically that night. He began to slowly, one bite at a time, one taste of wine at a time, one little story, a little bit of food information for me, Margaret sharing a story, he kind of sharing a story. All of a sudden, he became this animated storyteller, this happy guy who was so enthused about great food and wine and gathering just a simple meal in his home, and I'm just telling you, it was magic. That's all I can say.
Do you remember what you served him?
I've got the menu, as a matter of fact. One of the great things from that evening is Margaret is an artist, and so she created a menu that she did from watercolors, and I've got the menu at home. I can't remember everything. I think there's a soft shell crab course. No, I don't remember. I don't.
You shouldn't have said that.
No. One would think, you know, too many years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, but anyhow, Peter wants to get right into the recipes, and I think that although it sounds like we're talking about down-home country food, let me preface this whole discussion about the individual dishes by saying that they are very sophisticated. They may be simple, but they are sophisticated and delicious and very contemporary, even though they rest on tradition. But now, Peter, you have specific dishes eyeing up. Go ahead.
I just thought it would be fabulous if you could pick maybe one dish out of each season and explain, you know, why it's particularly special? Is the one ingredient that's really terrific?
All right. Which month would you care to start with?
You can start wherever you like. Start at the beginning, go to the end, and then stop, I guess. Usually a sensible way to go. Are you going to grab a book?
Yeah, I've got a book in front of me here just as a reference point. Should we start in the month we're in, or should we start at the beginning of the book?
Why don't we start in the month we're in? November and December together, which for much of the nation are the more difficult months of the year to be able to put fresh items on the menu that you'd like to be able to.
Well, that's right. And oftentimes I think that there's the root vegetables and the winter vegetables are not as common in people's kind of day-to-day cooking. And we try to kind of celebrate a few of those kind of common but not appreciated things like cauliflower. You'll notice we kind of make a real commitment at the beginning of the book to cauliflower and ways to use it. And so I love the cauliflower gratin. The great thing about that recipe is the heirloom, whether it's heirloom, cauliflower, or just regular white cauliflower, depending on where you live and what you have access to, both are fabulous. That recipe has such richness and fullness of flavor that it and simplicity. You had talked about these recipes kind of sounding, and if you read the recipe, kind of simple. Heirloom, cauliflower, gratin. Okay, what's the big deal? Well, the ingredients all put together in a logical, well-written recipe that's fundamentally sound in terms of flavor building, and then using a simple addition like a little truffle oil takes a very simple recipe and elevates it to real chef quality flavor profiles and depth of flavor that just, I think, head turning food. Wow. People eat it and they're just, you know, they just kind of get quiet and go, all you hear is, yum, wow, that kind of thing. That's a perfect example of what we tried to achieve. Sweet potato tortellini, one of my all-time favorite, very simple pastas. But, you know, one thing about that recipe is you have to have a kind of a comfort level with making your own pasta. So we had to balance in our mind how to have recipes that were simple enough for a home cook. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are very serious about cooking at home and aren't afraid to do pasta. They all bought little KitchenAids and they all want to try it. They all have a favorite little pasta dough recipe, and we've got one here. And so we want to kind of balance those things. Very important. Gosh, I would say that all of Ide's Italian family recipes are just right on the money. You know,
even those donuts look good, by the way.
Yeah, the donuts. And, you know, the nice thing about the donut recipe, it's very simple recipe. It's a beignet recipe, essentially. I've making those donuts since I worked for Bradley Ogden 100 years ago. And I'll tell you, it's a simple, simple, great recipe that I really love.
Now you're going to make this one, Rabbit. It's braised rabbit.
Oh, yes.
We have two rabbits sitting in the freezer.
Let's do the rabbit recipe next. The book fell open at that page because I was just looking for a rabbit recipe, and sure enough, there is one.
Yes. Okay, which rabbit recipe are you on? Are you on the tamales?
I have braised rabbit with vegetable ragu.
Right. Well, I'll tell you.
That's spring, is it?
Yeah,
no, it's March.
You guys jumped
April.
Into spring on me, didn't you?
We did.
Yeah,
we did.
You guys got to give me a heads up on that.
No, that's all right. I was sure you'd be able to follow me.
I'm with you. All right. So, yeah, and that's in the beginning, because that's where we begin.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, you begin there, I guess, because that's perhaps it's the most exciting season.
For me, like I had said in the introduction, I find myself a little bit bored with school and an average student, and I looked forward to nothing more than getting out into the world and experiencing the world. And so that's where life was lived for me, and I learned all my greatest lessons in the living, not in the learning, in school. And so,
do you even have your wife's family recipe for homemade spaghetti and meatballs in here?
Yeah, oh, it's a good one too.
And there's something I've never seen, and I mean, my background's Italian too. This is Italian Christmas with the Muranos. But you have a basket of fried greens, celery fritters? I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, well, you know, Italian cuisine is like, you know, it's no different. Kind of has an evolution within families even. And so to that end, you can find, as an Italian yourself, wow, that's cool. I've never seen that before. And it's not really surprising because every family kind of has their own kind of thing they do.
Well, now let's be really challenging now. Your family is from Scotland.
Correct.
And probably back a couple of centuries ago, the food there wasn't very exciting. It's certainly there have been some vast improvements since then, but do you have any trace of your Scottish heritage in any of the recipes?
None.
Okay. No, we have no haggis.
Yeah, we've had haggis. We've been in Scotland.
I've done a lot of things, but I've not eaten the haggis.
It's not worth much.
Have you been in Scotland recently?
Nope, dying to go. It's on the life list. Have not been ever.
Because there are some absolutely wonderful products coming out of the ocean there now. For example, lobster throughout Europe is mostly fished off the coast of Scotland, and the scallops are absolutely wonderful.
Oh, the scallops are great.
You can get scallops. We actually had scallops in the southwestern part of the country at Michael Caine's restaurant, which were fished that morning and served in the evening.
Well, you can't beat that. I mean, the whole idea. I think that at the end of the day, wherever you are in the world, you find food of that place, of that moment, of that season, and you find that person who knows how to handle it and reflects that. You can do that. Doesn't matter where you are in the world, you're going to eat well. And so whenever we travel, we look for those places. We go to the farmers markets. We talk to people. We find out who's doing that kind of food. Because you know if you can find that kind of food, you're going to find a real reflection of a place, of an authenticity, a caring for products, and oftentimes culinary history woven in there at some point. So I have no doubt where we travel to Scotland and find those places, we would experience amazing food.
Yeah. You will also get salmon that's just unbelievable.
Right, yeah. And you know the problem with a salmon in America is we're all eating farm-raised salmon that tastes like nothing.
Yeah, I know.
And we don't do that here. We only serve salmon that's wild salmon, that's wild-caught salmon that tastes like salmon should taste. Even if it's only for a nanosecond in terms of its time on the menu. We write our menu every day, so if we have salmon for a day, so be it. We move on to whatever shows up at the back door that's just stunning and beautiful and compelling. Like Christmas morning every day, you look at the back door, things start showing up, your imagination goes wild, you start writing menus and you start cooking, and that energy just is transferred from the back door through the hands of the cooks into the plates of the food that the customers eat, and hopefully you've created memory cuisine food that's wow food, you know.
So you have producers who drop things at the back door. That's how you know what you're getting is really good every day. Isn't that wonderful?
At the end of the day, we talked about the purveyors earlier. That relationship we have with these people, there's hundreds of them. They all kind of have their moment throughout the course of the year, and they show up with whatever it is, wild mushrooms, root vegetables, oysters, shrimp. I mean, stuff that'll just blow you away. And then the creative process takes over, and all we need to do is stay true to our craft and really pay homage to those ingredients, to handle them with respect and care, and put out food that's compelling.
Now, Birmingham is a southern city, and there's a southern tradition that's behind a lot of what goes on there. Anne has the book open at Oven Roasted Chicken Breast with Anson Mills Grits. Why don't you, to round out our view of the universe of Hot and Hot Fish Club cooking, talk about a dish that's definitively southern?
Right, well, that's a great one, because we kind of had started this conversation before we started taping about muscadines and scuppernons. Your family.
Funny names.
Great grapes that are traditional southern grapes and often associated with wine, sweet wine, and not a lot of information about them outside of the South. Well, these grapes are particularly flavorful. They've got this wonderful sweet, musty, yeasty flavor, and the skins are thick, and the flavor is just so intense on these grapes. We do a lot of different things with them, but specifically in this recipe, the Anson Mill grit, let's start with the grits, okay? The Anson Mill is a small mill in South Carolina that has rescued heirloom varieties out of oblivion and now begun to propagate them.
Yeah, we love them. Absolutely love them.
They're amazing. Their company is amazing. What they do is amazing, and we love them. And so they get these beautiful grits. We both get white grits and yellow grits from them. But those grits have a texture to them and a flavor to them that is so unlike grits that people understand and have such a negative connotation with, largely outside of the South.
Right.
But those people inside the South know grits are great. But even for Southerners, these grits take grits to the next level. Texturally, from a flavor profile, they're just amazing. So when you eat them, you get more than just flavor. You get, again, that texture. So you've got a great grit recipe, and then you've got a wonderful, simple chicken preparation, not complicated. You brown a chicken breast, you flip it over, you throw some shallots, some fresh thyme, these beautiful grapes in the pan. You roast those in a hot oven, whether it's wood burning or otherwise, and then you let these grapes kind of begin to release their juice. You touch the pan with a couple of ounces, or not even, I think it's a couple of tablespoons the recipe calls for, of verjus.
One cup. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you pull the chicken out of the pan when it's just cooked, you reduce the verjus with the grapes, and so the natural sweetness of the muscadines and the scuppernons mix with the sweet but yet acidic verjus being green grape juice that's just been, green grapes that have been squeezed, so you have the benefit of the fruit, in other words, the soft acid, that fruity acid, along with the acid, the tartness, which you need to balance the richness of the grits. So the chicken throws off some of its natural liquid. You've got the grapes throwing off some of their natural liquid. It all reduces down to intensify. You melt just a few knobs of butter in there, finish with a little parsley, and then put the chicken on a little pile of grits, put the sauce over the chicken with the grapes, and I'm just going to tell you, it is simple, 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 but very complex in its flavor profile and the wow factor. You eat that and you go, this is the hope of simple cooking, that you can get such depth of flavor and such interesting, wonderful flavor out of simple ingredients.
Chris, all I can say is I wish Birmingham, Alabama was a lot closer to Pittsburgh than it is, because we come and see you every week, and I'm sure you have lots of diners who do exactly that.
Well, the good news is that's very true. We have people here who are very, very loyal patrons, and Birmingham is a very dynamic city that has people coming from all over the world, but if you've heard of the Hot and Hot, you may not know about it, so your expectations may be fairly limited. So people come from all over the world, for largely the University of Alabama at Birmingham, big research community, medical research, and literally people from all around the world.
Yeah, we had a pediatrician who left to take over director of your children's hospital a long time ago.
One of the best children's hospitals in the country,
yeah,
by the way.
It is.
And so they come here, and again, kind of fairly low expectations. It's Birmingham. People have some negative connotations with our city. And they come here, and they're blown away. They're like, oh, my God, who knew it? An amazing town in more ways, the tapestry and the nuances of things that go on here, and food is certainly a part of that.
And don't be surprised, then, to find us on your doorstep, and I just
you
want
should.
To say.
You should travel to come to Birmingham and check it out.
And,
I'm serious.
And meanwhile,
we would love to have you.
Meanwhile, listeners, get this book, Hot and Hot Fish Club Cookbook. And also check out the website, which is actually that, hotandhotfishclub.com, and then sign up for the e-newsletter also.
Hopefully a good little bit of information there that everybody can use on a monthly basis to help them, cook better on a daily basis. That's what that newsletter is all about, just to try to help folks.
Please. Well, it's good meeting you too, Chris.
Yeah, please give our greetings to your lovely wife and to our old friend Frank Stitt next time see him, which will probably be soon
in May, I think, in Charleston. Are you guys going to be in Charleston?
I think it's in March. I think it's in March, and we'll certainly hope to be there if we can. In the meantime, thank you so much for talking to us on the menu.
Well, Peter and Ann, thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.
Take care.
Well, I mean,
There you
a
have
little
it.
Sunshine's sounding really good to me.
Yeah, it seems like a little sunshine and a lot of wonderful food entered our lives. We hope you enjoyed our guests. We thought they were all great people, and we're looking forward to seeing them soon. And in the meantime, between now and then, and between now and next week, we'll say...
Bye-bye.